But first, a question arrives. How does a book or a set of books, how do perfection of wisdom texts turn into a bodhisattva, turn into a goddess? How does that happen? So, I'm not quite sure whether I mentioned it last week, but I certainly mentioned Nagarjuna. According to the Buddhist tradition, according to the sort of mythological history of the perfection of wisdom, the perfection of wisdom teachings were given by Shakyamuni. They were given by the historical Buddha. But the historical, but the people who were around when the historical Buddha was around, they weren't quite sorted enough for these teachings, for teachings quite this exalted. So what the Buddha did was he taught the Nagas. He taught the Nagas the perfection of wisdom. So Nagas are, well, they're a bit like, they're pretty much dragons, actually. They live at the depths, they live in the bottom of oceans and lakes. So they're creatures of the depths. And like dragons, they often guard treasures. Yeah? So the treasure they were given to guard was the perfection of wisdom texts. And these teachings are said to have become available to us when Nagarjuna, who was a Buddhist teacher, received these teachings from a Naga princess. She came up from the depths of the lake and gave the perfection of wisdom text to this chap Nagarjuna, who's reputed to be the founder of an entire school of Buddhist philosophy, the middle school of the middle way, the Majjhimikas. Now, one of the points that I hadn't really thought about that Vasantra makes extremely well, I think it's mainly in Meeting the Buddhas actually, is how blasé we've become about books. Most of us have more books than we can read or are ever likely to read. I certainly have. In fact, I've got more Buddhist books than I'm likely to read. Certainly, I've got more Buddhist books than I'm able to practice. We take them for granted. They're everywhere, you know. Even remaindered bookshops, charity shops, there's the Dharma is kind of all over the place. And in a way, we're sort of awash in this sea of printed material, aren't we? There's just like, you can't move for written nonsense. I remember when I was a kid, actually. I often hear talks by people. I hear talks by order members, and they talk about having these, you know, these profound revelationary moments when they were eight and things like that. And I always think, nope, not me. But one thing I did do when I was a kid was I remember trying not to read anything. I remember sort of coming back from Nana's, as it were, and on the journey back from Nana's to home, trying not to read anything, and always failing miserably, always ending up reading the bus stop or the, you know, bill posters or things like that, you know. And there's a lot more around to read than there was now in the 70s, I suppose, when I was coming back from Nana's. Coming back from Wallasey, from me Nana's, through the Mersey Tunnel. Actually, that reminds me. When I first moved to Rivendell, I was only there a few weeks, and after I'd been on retreat a couple of weeks, I drove into London. And somehow or other, I'd forgotten about billboards. And I drove into London after a couple of weeks on retreat, and was just like, really big things with lots of information. That's really strange. That's really intrusive on my consciousness. Leave me alone. So we've got extremely used to books. They're all over the place, yeah? And last week I mentioned that the first printed book that there is a copy of a Perfection of Wisdom text, yeah? I also said something that isn't true, actually. It's not that the oldest book in the world is a Buddhist text, but the oldest Buddhist book is a Perfection of Wisdom text, yeah, which dates from the first century before Christ. I think there are books around that are older than that. I don't know what they are, but there are some, I think. I think there's some Hindu texts that are older than that, or Vedic texts that are older than that. And I think some Chinese texts are as well. We have to sort of imaginatively engage with what it would be like to live in a world where there were probably fewer Buddhist books in the country than there are in our library, you know, in most countries than there are in our library. There certainly weren't any in our tradition. But, you know, if you wanted to study the Dharma, first you were going to have to learn to read, and almost nobody read. Yeah? Secondly, you were probably going to have to learn to read in a language that wasn't your own. Thirdly, you were probably going to have to walk hundreds, if not thousands of miles to get to a book to read, and then stay there as long as you wanted to study it, because you weren't going to be able to take it away with you. You could feasibly, you might be able to copy it. And it's quite hard to think of information being, you know, we live in this age where you can, you know, I can sit at the internet and I can look up huge amounts of stuff about perfection of wisdom texts, you know, for this talk. I didn't this week, but I did a bit last week, yeah? It's difficult to get your head round how inaccessible Buddhist teachings were, really. But if you read any biographies of early Buddhist practitioners, they spent huge quantities of their life travelling enormous distances, having to work to get enough money to be able to travel very long distances at enormous personal risk to themselves, simply to be able to study the Dharma, simply to be able to find Dharma texts. And people like Marpa, who was a translator, a Tibetan translator, having to make these dangerous treks through the Himalayas down into India, get horrible swampy malarial diseases, translate these texts and then carry them all the way back, and often lose them on the way, for, you know, get beaten up by bandits or something. Or with Marpa, I think somebody was jealous and pushed all his books, got paid someone to push all his books in a boat when they were going across a river. So it's difficult for us to get our heads around this in this sort of sea of printed piffle that we find ourselves in. It's hard to think that the printed word could be so precious and so rare, really. But perhaps you can begin to imagine how, in that sort of context, an enormous degree of reverence would start to develop for Buddhist texts, yeah? For the Dharma in word form, a distillation of the Dharma. And sometimes the development of the Mahayana, the sort of second stage of Buddhist teachings, it's talked about as the development of book cults, as being one of these sort of major Buddhism, sort of Mahayana sutras, as being one of the big parts of the development of the Mahayana. And if you read these texts, they are quite strange in a way, because they often consist of very lengthy sections going on about how wonderful they are. So the actual text consists of going on about, where does this happen a lot? This happens in the White Lotus Sutra a bit. It happens in the Sutra of Golden Light a lot. There are huge sections of the Sutra of Golden Light which are just going on about how fantastic the Sutra of Golden Light is. And then it's kind of, well, where is this sutra that's so fantastic? And it's just itself being enthusiastic about itself. When I was in, a bunch of us went on a little pilgrimage to India earlier in the year. And whilst we were over there, I bought this. So this is a Tibetan Dharma text. So this is what books looked like, as it were. This is what's sort of meant by a book. It's not a sort of, I think our books are called codexes, aren't they? Books with a spine that we're used to. But this is what a Tibetan text would look like. So you'd have covers and individual pages. And the guys I bought this for were a bit bewildered. Why was this Englishman buying? These monks were sort of thinking, why was I buying this Tibetan? But it's in Tibetan. Yes or no? Do you want to know what it is? No, I don't want to know what it is. Because if I don't know what it is, this is the whole of the Dharma. Yeah? This is the Dharma in here. I don't know what it is, but I know it's the Dharma. And it can stand for me for the whole of the Dharma in a way. In the same way that, well, we'll look at it in a bit, the books that the Prajnaparamita holds or has in her iconography represent absolute, you know, as close to the truth, to absolute truth, as concepts can get. If I knew what it was, it would only be a bit of the Dharma. It's funny, some people kind of can get this. When I was out there, I told somebody about this and they said, oh, you should find out what it is. And it's kind of like, no, that's not the point. The point is that this is the Dharma. here. I'm very fond of it just being, you know, just having this thing that represents the whole of Buddhist teaching to me in a way. Which is why I brought it in to put it on the shrine. So as we heard last week, the Prajnaparamita texts evolved through time. Yeah, they went through these stages of expansion and condensation. And then they met the Tantra. Yeah. So I'm sure you can imagine when you've got this intellectual thunderbolt of the perfection of wisdom, this teaching which is trying to blast through all of our conceptualizations about reality. When that comes into contact with the diamond of the Tantra, yeah, this transformation through direct experience of the Vajrayana, then something mysterious and extraordinary is going to happen. And that's how the Bodhisattva Prajnaparamita was born. This is where the goddess comes from. The goddess comes from, you could say, the mystical union of the Vajrayana and the perfection of wisdom. Moving beyond concepts into direct experience and making the perfection of wisdom a direct experience as much as possible. So it's time for us to meet the goddess, say a little bit about what she might look like. So she's a golden colour, and she's often referred to as the mother of all the Buddhas. Actually, this is an epithet which is, it's very hard to find a female deity in Buddhism that isn't called the mother of all the Buddhas somewhere. But Prajnaparamita is in a way sort of stands up, holds that title a bit more fully than the others, because usually Buddhas and Bodhisattvas are 16 years of age. They're usually 16 years of age, sort of traditionally being the point of sort of first, you know, the point of maturity, as it were. Now, my experience of 16-year-olds is not of them being completely inspiring. It's largely of them being rather irksome. Some of you have got a lot more experience of teenagers than I have.